Today on the 21st show, the campaign to be the next U.S. Senator from Illinois after Dick Durbin's decision to not seek re-election. We'll have the fifth in our series of conversations. Pamela Denise Long is an occupational therapist and political commentator. She's seeking the Republican nomination. We'll talk with her live in studio about domestic policy, foreign affairs, and what it'll take to win the nomination of President Donald Trump's Republican Party while also remaining viable for a general election in a blue state. We also want to put your questions to the candidate, so give us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. I'm Brian Mackey with Denise Long for the hour today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Today we hear from another of the half-dozen men and women seeking the Republican nomination for United States Senate in Illinois. This is the seat being vacated by Dick Durbin, who decided not to seek a sixth term. Pamela Denise Long was born and raised in Mississippi, though her family history goes back several generations in the Metro East region of Illinois near St. Louis. She herself came to the area to attend Lewis and Clark Community College, where she earned an associate degree. Eventually, she earned an education doctoral degree in organizational development from Grand Canyon University, a private Christian school in Phoenix. Long has worked as an occupational therapist and more recently as a consultant. For several years, she was also an adjunct professor at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. In recent years, she's also written political commentary that's appeared in outlets including Newsweek and Real Clear Politics. And now she is running for Senate. Pamela Denise Long joins us live today in our studios in Urbana. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Looking forward to the conversation.
And listeners, as usual, we have a lot to get to in the course of this hour. We'll talk about her background, foreign policy, domestic policy, and more. We also want to hear from you. Our phone lines are open throughout the hour. If you have questions for Denise Long, join the conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right, let's start with your early life. What was it like growing up in Mississippi?
Oh my gosh, you know, I appreciate it now as a 52-year-old woman who is a mother myself. It was the best. It was the kids growing up in the country, making mud pies, building houses, exploring the bayous. I'm surprised all of us are alive and have all of our digits. You know, I didn't realize how poor we were because it just was what it was, but I appreciate it in hindsight.
This is mid-70s into the 1980s.
Yeah, I'm an 80s kid. So, you know, I grew up with the Casey Kasems, American Top 40, and the whole riding your bike and playing outside until, you know, it was dark and folks came to look for you.
What brought you to Illinois? I mentioned you went to community college in Metro East.
Yeah, family. So we have a family farm, or had a family farm. We sold it a couple of years ago, 173 years in the family in Fosterburg, Illinois. And I wanted to be near my sister. We grew up together, you know, sharing a bed in our little tin roof shack in the middle of a cotton field in Mississippi. She's 5 years older than I. So when I graduated high school, I took the first thing smoking up here, which happened to be a Greyhound bus.
So you say, I've seen reported anyway, that you became a Republican in 2008. Yeah. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So, you know what? I was always excited to vote. It was almost like a rite of passage, right? To turn 18 and you can finally participate in this thing. You know, my grandmother wasn't particularly political, I don't think, but I do remember her talking about, you know, Ronald Reagan and a particular congressman who was in Mississippi. You know, she wasn't a fan of either of them, and I didn't think too much of it, but I was always aware that, you know, voting was a thing. I skipped to my polling place when I could cast a vote for the first time, but I wasn't politically conscious. And so I started to think about what my political values were and how political values should align with your action as a civic engagement. So when Barack Obama was running against Alan Keyes for this same U.S. Senate seat in 2003-4-ish, I really started to pay attention. And what really awakened me was standing outside my church on the morning that Barack Obama was going to speak, and someone had rented a mobile billboard that showed what happens with a baby with an abortion. And I remember the women around me being really upset that they had to see it. Like, how dare he do that? I'm assuming they thought Keyes did it, and maybe he did. But anyway, and it was remarkable to me that they weren't concerned about what they saw. And so, especially in front of a church. And so I started to just really pay attention to their race. I found it fascinating. And over time, as, you know, we were married and making more money and looking at, you know, talk radio and also PBS and all the other things, thinking about who do I want to be? How do I want to show up? And low taxation and pro-life and all of those things really resonated with me. And so for the first time in life, I joined a party and paid dues to be a member of something.
Yeah, it's interesting. Alan Keyes is a deep, deep cut in Illinois politics. He was brought in late in the campaign cycle, was trounced by Obama in that election.
Predictably.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it came off as carpetbagging. He's a brilliant man. But that sort of not understanding reading the room in blue Illinois, even then, and also just the racial politics of it, let's just call a thing, it just didn't look right. And I think for many people, it didn't land well.
How do you mean the racial politics?
Well, it's like, you know, the Republican Party is generally perceived as a white man's sort of party, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the idea that they brought Keyes in with no real significant ties to this area.
He's the way Maryland, that, I think, yeah.
Yeah, the way that Obama did, you know, this grassroots guy who's, you know, moving around the city of Chicago, you know, speaking for the people and all of that. It just didn't look right. It looked like he was a brilliant man. Again, it looked like he was being a puppet.
Yeah, interesting. All right, so why do you want to be a United States senator?
You know, the funny part about it is I didn't want to be a United States senator. I'd looked at politics several times. People had asked me, you know, you should run because you have so many good ideas and you have so many strategies. I like your analysis, and I write a lot, right, is how I process my thoughts. I consulted with the Trump campaign back in 2023 as I was moving around D.C. doing consulting around public relations with immigration moderation, how to actually activate people to the awareness that mass immigration, both legal and illegal, we know that it affects Americans, right? It's a common sense thing, but it's also a data thing. I would tell people, they say, you should run. And I'm like, yeah, when Dick Durbin retires, I'll do it. Not thinking that Dick Durbin was going to retire anytime soon. And I think just the life and time and the political moment that we're in requires I do more than just write and ask other people to do the things that could and should be done. And so I had to have more skin in the game. So I decided to throw my hat in. And the more I talked with people traveling around the state, be it rural, urban, suburban, the more I wanted to run because we were resonating. And what they wanted to see is something that I believe I can do well.
It's interesting. Not many experienced, on the Republican side anyway, not many experienced politicians are interested in this race. What does that say to you about the play of things? And, you know, I guess maybe, well, we'll start with that question. Yeah.
I'm a glutton for punishment, as well as information. It's a slog. Things don't change, though, unless you get in there and get your hands dirty. You know, I'm not even supposed to be here having this conversation with you. I mean, my parents died before I turned 3. My dad died when I was 2 weeks old. My mom died literally a week before I turned 3. I was raised by my maternal grandmother. I've been through hell and back for so many reasons, for all the things, the traumas and all the things. I'm a first generation college graduate, right? I'm not supposed to be me, whatever that means, right? My grandmother didn't have a high school education. She just told me and my sister, education is the way. I don't know if she knew what that meant, but both of us like took it to the hilt. She's a doctor, I'm a doctor serving people. So I think that experienced politicians look at this and think there is no way a Republican is going to win in the blue state of Illinois. I'm not your average person. I am not a hardliner on politics. I think about the nuance of things. I speak truth to power, no matter who that power is. I believe in this country, and I had to fall out of love with it, to listening to all the stuff about how America hates Black people and, you know, blah, 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 and to fall in love with it. And so I'm here for the fight. And best case scenario, I'm a model of what our party should be. We should be able to speak to everyone, even if everyone doesn't get everything they need. But we should also be focused on problem solving rather than pointing fingers. And so I'm here to offer Illinoisans an opportunity for that. You know, and I'm here until March 17th. And if they feel so inclined, until November 3rd and the swearing in. So,
All right. Let me take a moment to remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We're speaking with Pamela Denise Long, a candidate for United States Senate in the Republican primary, which is coming up in March. Early voting opens next month here in Illinois. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. All right, we have the luxury of an hour, so I think we can go, you know, deep and wide on some political policy topics today. So let's start with what's been in the news this week as we are talking. Should America seek to obtain Greenland from Denmark one way or another?
Man, what a surprise, I think, for most people, right? The world is changing. In significant ways that I don't think the average person is really thinking about. China is a force, and Greenland is and has been historically a significant physical opportunity and a gateway for our security.
America's had as many as a dozen bases there in the past. Still have a couple, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and the mutual, you know, treaty for military support and whatnot, the melting of the ice caps offers opportunity to mine rare earth and other minerals. And there's quick and easy access for trade routes there. And whoever really controls, if you will, Greenland, Denmark currently being part of Denmark, really does, will control, I think, a lot of what of movement and trade. And so, of course, given that Greenland is right north of us, we would want to have that. Now, I am concerned about the threats of military force, especially against allies, and how that could push people toward those that are in the BRICS sort of nations, and how also could fracture our relationships because we can't be in this world by ourselves.
And we saw the Prime Minister of Canada over the weekend. There was a front page on the Wall Street Journal where he's shaking hands with the Chinese leader, saying, It's over with America now. We're moving toward the Chinese.
Well, and that's the thing that happens when you saber rattle. You can push people toward I'm going to say the enemy, but the opposition. Which in the case, let's be real, everybody knows that China and America has been in sort of this sort of standoff for a while. And the reality is that China produces more cars than we do. Taiwan with its semiconductor manufacturing, and the same with China. Most of the world needs China more than they need us in that regard from a production perspective, because we're ultimately dependent upon the rest of the world for everything as well, from medicines to electronics and the like. So something has to give there. I, of course, would caution on doing too much saber rattling because we're in a vulnerable position and that's hard to acknowledge.
So you think that we shouldn't take Greenland by force then?
I would hope that we can negotiate something without having to use force. Imagine this, though. Imagine if people are pushed, Greenland, Denmark, and European allies are pushed toward China because of their dependence on China as well, for the reasons that I've mentioned and others. Then would we let China have Greenland? Or well, we move to force?
I mean, we don't have to get too in the weeds, but sure. I mean, any sort of incursion of China into Greenland would trigger NATO, assuming NATO still exists.
Well, yeah.
And we would have to defend it right. In that case.
Yeah. Well, and there's some advocacy to get us out of NATO as well, right? So there's there is a lot of advocacy to get us out of NATO, partly
because
of cost.
What do you think about that?
Man, the isolationist move is concerning. I'm a nationalist. I do believe that the nation that we built should serve Americans first and foremost. But we also, again, cannot be isolated in the nation over here in this hemisphere all by ourselves without allies. I think there are ways in which we've certainly had incursions into other countries because of, you know, our NATO allies, like Libya has been a disaster since we went there because, let's be real, of the Golden R, the threat that was not threat or promise, whatever, that was made. I hope it doesn't come to force. I hope it doesn't come to that.
Yeah. What about that idea that, you know, there are people who say America shouldn't be, you know, the United States has been a global superpower since World War II, right, which is the lifetime of most of us here. America First and MAGA seem to want to pull us back from that. Is that the right direction for America?
I don't think isolationism is the right direction. I believe that we have put profits over people for quite some time now. We've invested in foreign nations that have, you know, access to things that we don't, like, you know, MTG even outlined how, you know, parts of Israel, for example, have, you know, education support and, you know, universal health care and all of that kind of stuff, as well as other nations that we keep, you know, shaking our money tree at. But isolationism isn't it. I think we need to revisit, renegotiate, use diplomacy. I think if we do try to isolate ourselves, we may find that force is the only thing we have rather than shaking a hand and making a friend, or at least keeping the friends that we do have in a situation where literally China serves everyone. And we don't make a whole lot here where we could sustain ourselves. Even our own medicines, COVID proved a lot of that.
We need to take a break in about a minute and a half here. But how do you think about how the current U.S. Senate Republican majority has done in terms of working with or against or restraining the president in terms of his foreign policy stuff, right? Taking the leader of Venezuela, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Venezuela is one we can talk about for sure. We have three co-equal branches of government for a reason. Our form of government, a republic, has always depended upon willful submission to the constraints baked into that by those in power, and a will of the people to enforce those constraints and hold people accountable. I would love to see Congress do more of its job rather than be directed by the president, who is there to implement the laws of Congress. I would like to see Congress do more advising, more enforcement, more of those types of things that really do show our diplomatic heft.
All right, we are going to take a break. We are talking with Pamela Denise Long. She is a candidate for the Republican nomination for United States Senate. Of course, Senator Dick Durbin, who has been in office since 1997, I believe is the year. Yes, 1997, has decided not to seek re-election. Many, many people, I think it's something like 16 or 17 people on both sides of the aisle, are seeking to be his successor. The primary is coming up in March. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. We'll get to some calls after the break if you are waiting on the line. Again, 800-222-9455. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are speaking with Denise Long, Pamela Denise Long, on the ballot, candidate for the Republican nomination for United States Senate here in Illinois, for the seat being vacated by Senator Dick Durbin, who has been in office since 1997, a Democrat reelected, or I should say elected, five times by the people of Illinois. Long is an occupational, or I should say started work as an occupational therapist, has a doctoral degree in organizational development, has also been a political commentator, appearing in various outlets, including Newsweek. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us today. 800-222-9455. And let's go now to the phones. We have Joe calling from Urbana on line one. Joe, thank you for calling in.
Hey, good morning. I'm calling in because, Dr. Long, I mean, I'm glad that you're running. I'm a person of color also, but I think you're still, I hear you still excusing some of the Trumpisms. Republicanism, going back to Eisenhower Republicanism, is the taxes were high, and that was when really, if America did anything great then, that was when it was. The highways, the schools, colleges were almost free. And over since Reagan, republicanism has changed. It's become where let's support the 1% and let's screw the rest of the population of the country. And also intervention in other people's countries. Come on now. I thought this man said he wasn't going to intervene in other countries, but he seems to be intervening in every country. He wants Greenland. There is no. I'm a student of international relations. There is nothing in that we know about that is Russia or China wants Greenland. That is just a. I don't know what it is. I can't say it on radio, but that there is no evidence of that. And supporting that as a whole is, like, that doesn't make sense. Being a Republican means that you want to care about people. Eisenhower did it. The taxes on that side was 90%. Come on.
All right, Joe. I appreciate the call. Let's let Dr. Long take a moment to respond to that.
Yeah, I think it's a matter of the United States not wanting to risk allyship and control of China having an oversized control of the waterways there. Yeah, you know, it's interesting the promises that were made about non-interventionism. It makes me wonder if something has changed that we're not aware of from a national security perspective as everyday citizens. That would be my guess. Trump seemed certainly to be in his first term even someone who didn't want to go into wars and intervene and whatnot. So I'd certainly want to know what has changed. And I have to agree with Joe about how so much of, you know, taxation is high. I mean, Democrats are taxing the heck out of us here in Illinois. So we're getting taxed by both parties. I would love to see an actual elimination of the income tax, or at the very least, decreasing it significantly so that you're not paying so much of your wages through taxation and the like.
What would you fund United States government with if not an income tax?
Yeah, so I think we need to revisit that. I know the tariffs that Trump has talked about is one way to do that. Now, mind you, I'm quite well aware that the consumer generally pays for those tariffs. But I think there are ways in which, you know, businesses might be able to support some of that funding. We have certainly placed, again, profit over the people. And I don't think American households should be responsible for funding government. I mean, if we even cut the waste and abuse just a little bit that we've scratched the surface on now, we really should be questioning how much does the American government actually need, first of all, in order to run basic stuff, because we have so much money right now that we can fund other countries, right, and other things. So I think we need to revisit it from, you know, I hate to mention the DOGE because some people don't particularly care for it, but as an organizational development consultant, I think efficiency and effectiveness is and cost savings, right, needs to be baked into how we think about appropriation in general, and I don't think it is now at all.
DOGE seemed pretty disruptive to American government. I mean,
yes.
Do you think that was a positive
outcome?
I think
the way that was implemented was wild. It never needed to be an external third party that wasn't really an actual.
Wild is kind of an interesting term you use there.
It was unnecessary.
Okay.
It was unnecessary because we already have existing, well-vetted government agencies and departments that could
like
do that.
Like inspectors general.
Government accountability office.
In a lot of cases,
those types of things that can be repurposed and or with current structure to look at how we do things. Besides the fact that Congress writes all these appropriations bills and cuts all these checks, so to speak, and we don't ever look at, like, if it's done what it was supposed to do, when we should stop writing those checks, like, where's the money going? So that goes back to the efficiency and effectiveness that I think needs to be baked in. It does not need to be a third party coming in telling subject matter experts, professionals who know what they're doing, what to do. It needs to be baked into the current infrastructure, and it's already there.
Yeah, I can't speak as much to the federal budget. I'm not an expert in that, but I did cover Illinois state politics for many years. And I know that this idea that we can just, like, find efficiencies and cuts, like, it never really works out that way. Governor Bruce Rauner tried that for 4 years when he was Republican in charge. Well, we can get back to that. But, like, can you really, like, find enough, like, efficiencies and corruption and whatever to eliminate the income tax? Is that realistic?
Well, I think that's the question, is how do we stagger it? How do we design it? I'm not an expert either, but the point is there are experts. And if we're going to try to have the American people keep more of their dollar, we have to really look at how we're taxing them. And if the let's go with the premise that you have to tax the people in order to fund the government. How much funding does the government really need to do the core stuff of the people? Because right now we have so much money that we can fund other people around the world. And that, to me, seems like we're maybe taxing the people too much.
So this is interesting, because then we can get into some of the things that the government has cut, like medical research, pediatric cancer research. This is some of the fallout of the DOGE actions. Do you support those cuts?
I do not support cuts in research. First of all, I am a researcher, and I think that's very important. I think we need to look overall at what is happening. Arbitrary cuts don't help. It needs to be more analytical. That maybe means we need to slow down a little bit. I mean, gosh, we have appropriations bills that happen every single year, but it seems like every single year Congress is shocked that it's going to happen. We need to be doing the work. It's like a process that never ends. Every single year we need to be doing the work. Maybe we start looking at efficiencies and effectiveness, I don't know, in military spending, in foreign aid. Let's start there, just within a particular realm of our budget, and move across the systems, the silos that we budget there in a systematized sort of way.
Let's talk about some other domestic policy areas. You mentioned that abortion, a pro-life billboard or something like that, was part of your political awakening, I guess you'd say. Do you think there should be a national law prohibiting abortion?
So we've already, the Supreme Court already returned access to abortion to the states, and most conservatives and Republicans who consider themselves pro-life, and there are pro-life Democrats as well, right, adhere to the three exceptions, rape, incest, and life of the mother. Yeah, which is a no-brainer. And I always stomp on life of the mother because it's such a, like, obviously we can't have two dead people on our hands. That would be insane. So my concern with the answer is no. I struggle with the two exceptions because reality is that the baby's still a baby regardless of how it was conceived. I can't see myself supporting or going for an abortion. I also can't necessarily see myself forcing a woman who has been molested by her father or has been raped, forcing her to have a baby. So I have my personal sort of practice. And regardless of how a state regulates access to abortion, we cannot have the current situation we do, which is some states are so confused about if they can save the life of a mother who has an unviable or even actually dead child within her. We can't have that kind of lack of clarity because women are dying. Like, literally, that's not drama. That's not, you know, liberals saying things that aren't true. That's a reality, that there are women who are dying because their doctors aren't sure what kind of a, you know, it's not even an abortion because the child is dead, but what they can do to actually remove a dead child from a woman. That's insane.
So how do you resolve that ambiguity? A national law that does what?
Well, for one thing, I think states need to be more clear about the implementation and guidance that they provide to physicians. I think that the healthcare providers within organizations who do training and development need to do a better job of understanding the law and training the healthcare, the physicians and others who would intervene in a situation like we described between a mother and an unviable child. They need to train them on the law and what they can do. So it's a failure at multiple levels.
What about LGBT rights? Should marriage remain legal?
Oh, absolutely. So I'm libertarian in that regard. I don't care who you marry, like, for real. Well, let me just say, consenting adults who are unrelated, right? Because of, yeah. But otherwise, no, I've always been that way about that. Marry who you like. I also think you should be able to bequeath your stuff to whoever you like. I don't particularly care for an estate tax. If you've paid taxes on the goods that you have when you die, why should the person that you're bequeathing it to pay it as well? But yes, absolutely.
What about transgender healthcare? And let's start with adults. I mean, this is a really small, anywhere from 0.5% to 1.5% of the population. It seems to occupy a heck of a lot more than that of our politics. Mm-hmm. What do you think about healthcare access for adults?
For adults. Okay, so that's an important distinction because I do think there's room to talk about.
Yeah, we'll start with adults and go from there. Yeah.
You know, here, as I've been studying this issue and looking at some of the exemplars for transgender care, and I started with the Tavistock Center, and even looking back historically about, like, how
UK.
Did we get here?
Yeah.
How did we get here? I'm seeing that a lot of folks who are adults who identify as transgender also have concomitant mental health concerns and or history of abuse and whatnot. I always want to do least harm. And if there is a concern, a mental health concern, a developmental injury, a trauma that a person is experiencing, I want to make sure that we are providing the care that they need so that the decisions, permanent decisions to alter their bodies, are made from a healthy standpoint and from a standpoint of healing and not one from a trauma. For example, there have been stories that people have told who detransition about how they were sexually abused, and they were seeking to distance themselves from the body that had been molested. That sounds like a mental health concern to me that I would want to make sure that a person has access to. Of course, ultimately, it is an adult's right to alter their body in any way that they want, from earrings to tattoos to whatever, right?
Cosmetic surgery.
Sure.
Yeah.
I do not think, though, that some of the ways that public funding had been encouraged to be used. You know, I think Kamala Harris, for example, said that, you know, they would, public funding would be used to, you know, do transgender surgeries for adult immigrants and stuff like that. I think that's overboard.
One comment that was aired in ads tens of thousands of times after that. Yeah.
Sure, of course.
So, okay. So it sounds like you're saying no restrictions in law about adult, consenting adults, informed adults.
I think there need to be implementation guidance, especially if there's public funding for it, which means that mental health screening, like serious mental health screenings, right, needs to be a part of it. And one of the things we saw from the Tavistock Center, I'm going to go ahead and pull in adolescents here, is that many of the providers in their organization were prohibited from having discussions about mental health concerns because it was seen as a sort of normal trajectory that you could pick your gender. And so therefore, any concerns about how you got to the point of wanting to be an opposite gender or being compelled to feel like you're, you know, trapped in the body that you're born in shouldn't be had. And I just think that's a disservice to human beings. So my goal is to do the least harm. And I think that's especially the case when we're talking about children.
Okay. So we have a few minutes left. This is a big topic, but 3 minutes before the break here. But let's talk about children then. What do you think is going on in the minds of kids who say they are confused about their identity, right? We've had tomboys. That was a thing when I was a kid, certainly.
Yeah.
I mean, now maybe there's different, you know, some say there's different ways of expressing that and different ways of trying to live that. What do you think is happening?
I played football until, you know, I reached puberty and then you just couldn't and didn't. But so I get it. I think there are probably some people who genuinely feel disconnected from their sex. Like, they feel genuinely disconnected. They weren't abused. There's no trauma. They, for whatever reason, I don't know what that is. There would be interesting to actually, you know, look at that. And I don't know how you would research that. I think if the Tavistock Center is any example, there are parents who don't want their children to be gay, who have chosen and facilitated the transition of their children. That's absolutely wrong. There are also some children who are on the spectrum with pervasive developmental delays who are represented in the population that identifies transgender. I would think that those children would need more developmental supports because of the habits of mind and even the being uncertain within your own body that are concomitant with that before we go to, you know, hormones or permanent sort of surgical interventions.
Although I'm told by people in the field that surgery is quite rare for youth, hormones less so.
Yes.
Should there be federal laws about this? Should it be left to states?
You know, I think we're at, so a lot of this became part of the common conversation after 2020, right? So we're so in the very, like, middle, I think, of even critically talking about it, because for a while you couldn't even question it because you were a bigot or, you know, transphobic. I think now, hopefully, we're at a point where we can ask critical questions about what is best. And that's what I'm seeking to do. What is best? I don't think we're at a point where we can make laws about it. I don't think people really understand it well enough to do that. And I want to understand it better. So investigations into it, research into it, like real research into it, that's unbiased and really trying to get at what's the best way to serve humans. That's where I think we are.
800-222-9455 if you want to join us today. We are speaking with Pamela Denise Long, as her name will appear on the ballot. She goes by Denise Long, Dr. Long. She's a PhD in organizational development. She is running for the United States Senate in the Republican primary field. The election is coming up March 17th. Early voting opens next month. We are talking today. This is the, I think, fifth, sixth in our series of conversations with the 16 candidates who are seeking to succeed Dick Durbin in office. We'll have more after a short break. It's the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking with Dr. Pamela Denise Long. Did I say you had a PhD earlier? It's actually an EDD in organizational development.
Doctorate.
A doctorate in organizational development. Yes. Some people get very fired up about that.
Yes, they do.
800-222-9455 if you want to join us. She is running for United States Senate, seeking the Republican nomination for the vacancy being created by Dick Durbin's decision not to run for re-election for a sixth term. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us. I want to be sure we talk about immigration enforcement. I know you've been talking a lot about borders and immigration in the campaign, but on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate the job that ICE and the Border Patrol are doing in places like Chicago and Minneapolis?
Oh, my goodness. So there's several points of assessment there, right? Their commitment to getting the job done, a 10 for sure, right? The public relations element of getting the job done, less so. I think there are people who are gravely concerned about what it looks like and actually how people are experiencing it, experiencing the immigration enforcement. For example, the idea and advocacy today that ICE should be able to enter your home without a warrant is I'm a no.
There was a report that they have a memo that, for people who haven't seen this
leaked.
News, there was a memo that came out that apparently was dates to last May that said ICE can just enter in a home without a warrant.
Yeah, we're not doing that. And I think anyone who does that needs to be held accountable, and anyone facilitates that needs to be held accountable. So here, I'm a rule of law kind of gal. And so we cannot have government agents or officials who are advocating for things like that. You must have a warrant in order to enter someone's home. And I even have problems with the Patriot Act element where they're listening to us all the time. Right. And also selling our data. You know, there's a reason that when we say something around one of these devices that I look on my Facebook feed and, oh, look at that. It's Six Flags. And we just talked about it. So I have a problem with that as well. I do believe that Congress needs to be looking at what due process looks like for the 20 plus million people who were allowed to enter the nation against law. The truth is, the way that Joe Biden and Alejandro Mayorkas, the impeached Department of Homeland Security secretary, allowed folks to come into the nation was against immigration law. No doubt about it. Having said that, we need to look at what due process is. And I think Congress needs to be leading that conversation. I agree with the president that those folks who have an order to leave the country need to be escorted out. I do think it matters how we execute that. I did not want to see a situation where federal law enforcement, immigration enforcement was antagonistic with the people. And I think in many ways we are there. There are ways in which, of course, the people are very much upset that we're enforcing our immigration laws as well. Those laws have to be reinforced. So where's the balance? I think the people who are being violent with ICE agents need to be held accountable, and ICE agents who are being unnecessarily aggressive and or violent with the people need to be held accountable as well. There's enough accountability for everyone. We have to have people with the will to do it.
I mean, there's so much attention on the woman who was shot in Minnesota.
Renee.
Yeah, Renee Good. And the administration's response, for better, you know, whatever, you can watch the tape, and I think reasonable people might be able to have different perspectives on whether the officer felt threatened, should have been standing in front of the car. I mean, we can parse that a million ways. But the administration's response was to call her a terrorist, not we'll investigate this. How, as a senator, would you make sure there is accountability for wrongdoing? if wrongdoing has even happened, right? Is there even an investigation?
Yeah, so I don't think the Senate can pick up every incident that happens. I do think that we can look at patterns, and we can look at if the folks who are in supervisory roles for agents and the execution plans and whatnot are adhering to the rule of law, are ensuring that agents aren't put into undue danger, and also that they're not involved in situations that create danger for the public. So we can hold those folks in the executive branch, is where they would be accountable, is what I'm seeing. So that's part of it. And I think the other thing is there's so many in meetings and investigations and people testifying, and then nothing happens. What needs to happen is real, true accountability, whether that be censure, whether that be recommendation for removal, whether that be conferral to the Department of Justice, where that's relevant, or to the state, because states do have some jurisdiction there as well, especially with the people. It's actually pulling the lever on holding people accountable, because we cannot have it where there's lawlessness on either side of that equation.
One question I've asked every Republican office holder and candidate I've spoken to in the past few years is, we got some texts about this, Jai, and Elburn, for example, wants to know this too. Who won the 2020 presidential election? Was it free and fair?
I love that. Apparently, Joe Biden won the election in 2020. Yeah, well, he became president, okay. Right? I think that this hits at an election integrity issue. Well, it also hits at the issue of, you know, people asking, like, are you a sane person? Is what that question is kind of getting at for some people. Election integrity is important. If we don't have free, fair elections with little to no fraud, we don't have free and fair elections. We have to be able to count on it.
So was 2020, was it free and fair? Was there, you know, there's always some fraud. There's fraud in everything, right? People speed, people do.
Well,
this,
yeah. But... And I think there were some concerns that people had about when votes, you know, stopping, you know, counting votes early and all of that kind of stuff. And I've had and seen those reports, not just with the 2020 election, but with other elections as well. And so I think to the extent that there is fraud, it needs to be addressed. But Joe Biden became president in 2020 because I think more people voted for him in 2020. And here we have Donald Trump getting more of the votes as well. And we also have people saying that, you know, the election was stolen from him, for him. And so I think we have to do what we can to assure that our elections have as little to no fraud as absolutely possible.
And let me be clear about that. I think that both people who think that Trump somehow was deprived of the election and people who think that Harris was deprived of the election are nuts. I will say only one of those groups ended up storming the U.S. Capitol building
and
having the violent attack. Right. What do you think about the pardoning of everybody who was involved in that?
I think that there were egregious events that happened on January 6, 2020, and the people who engaged in that need to be held accountable. And the pardoning of them, unless there was some serious, at an individual basis of analysis, miscarriage and justice and how they were convicted, then they should have been held accountable. And I've stood by that.
I wonder what it's like. We have about 7 minutes left in the program, maybe a little less, since we need to leave time for credits. But what has it been like being a black woman running as a Republican, if I can be direct about it?
Yeah. And so that's part of it. But it's also like I don't toe a line. Right. I think for myself and I speak the truth and I'm not going to bend down and kiss a ring or kneel or whatever the stuff people are asking me to do. I stand on principle and I do that no matter what power's in the room. Being a black woman as a Republican.
And maybe some context here. The latest YouGov Economist poll. 89% of black voters had an unfavorable view of the president, 8% favorable.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you would have answered that survey question.
Yeah. So here's what I tell people. I'm not Donald Trump. Donald Trump is not running through me. I'm not a surrogate for anyone. I am Pamela Denise Long, a mother, a longtime Illinoisan and a concerned citizen who is running to apply whatever gifts, talents, abilities, and analysis I have to solve problems for the people. That includes your grandchildren and mine, because I want all of us to inherit a nation that makes sense. There are things that Donald Trump does that I agree with in theory and sometimes in practice. And there are things that he does that I disagree with, and I call it out. I did the same with Harris. I did the same with Biden. And so I think that people, there are some things, though, where people can find no good in anything that he does. And I think that's a problem as well. When there's truth spoken, it doesn't matter who speaks it. And certainly I plan to govern in the same way that I've lived my life, which is I cannot have my voice co-opted by anyone. And when I see something happening on the Democrat or Republican side that is not right, that is against principle, I'm going to call it out, but I'm also going to call it in. Here's an alternative way to see it. That's just how I roll.
Dick Durbin, you're running to succeed. Dick Durbin, whom the people of Illinois have elected 5 times. Is there anything positive you can say about his record in office?
You know, I think that he has changed a bit over time. I think he has also become, you know, a line tower.
I mean, he's the number two leader in his party, so I guess that's to be expected.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, I don't toe a line. I think the longer you're in, the more likely you are to become the system. You know, I think that, you know, he probably has a good heart, and I think he probably stayed a little too long.
Why do you think Republicans have struggled so much in Illinois in statewide races? I mean, no Republican has won since Donald Trump really has been the dominant force in American politics.
Yeah, Mark Kirk was before that.
Bruce Rauner. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 2014.
Well, I think Rauner, for one thing, right? People gave it a shot and they ain't like the way it tasted. And I can get that. We didn't have a budget, and I get the whole supermajority deal. I think also Republicans' public relations needs a good massaging. When I consulted with the Trump campaign back in 2023, that was part of what I was talking about. My candidacy is unique because I do have crossover appeal. Socioeconomics, education, geographic, like people in downstate like me, people in urban, like Black folks love me. I've done a lot of advocacy in the Black community. I believe in the radical Republican ethos. I think whatever happened in the 60s or 70s with the Southern strategy, we need to shake that off. I think we need to focus more on solutions and bringing our thought leadership to bear on solving problems. And we need to reach out with people. We don't reach out to the Black community. And we need to reach out to all Illinoisans about the issues that they have.
What is the difference today, if you see one, in being Republican, conservative, and Trump? Because I think the president doesn't want to see a distinction there. How do you see that?
When someone tells me they're a conservative, I ask them, what are you conserving? I think that makes a big difference. So that tells me a lot. As a Republican, I believe in full representation of all the people, like the literal word republic, right? Where everyone gets represented. I'm not unable to have conversations with anyone. They may not like what I say, but they'll inform me and nuance my perspective and vice versa. I think with Donald Trump, he is a star. We grew up with him, right? In music and TV. And I think he is used to being the executive in the room, and you do what I say or you're fired. And I think he leads sort of in that way. And I think I would love to see more of our Congress people provide nuance to his approaches to things. I think he has good intentions for the most part, but he definitely needs more nuancing. And I think people are scared to do that, whereas I'm not.
You're not?
No.
Would you, how would you have voted on January 6th, right?
What do you mean?
Well,
to codify the election or not?
Yeah.
Oh, exactly. To codify the election. Absolutely. Yeah.
And then minority position among members in the House anyway.
To codify the election for sure. And then if there are such significant concerns that there was voter lack of integrity, I'd want to investigate that from the congressional perspective, especially since it's a federal election, even though states have the implementation obligation for elections, for sure.
All right. Pamela Denise Long is running for the United States Senate on the Republican side in the race to succeed Dick Durbin. The election is March 17th. Early voting happens at different times in different parts of Illinois, but it will begin in February. If you have questions for future candidates in this series, or if you want to listen to some of our past interviews with other candidates who are seeking their party's nomination for United States Senate, you can find those at our website, which is 21stshow.org, 21stshow.org. While you're there, you can find our email address and every other way to contact us. Coming up tomorrow on the program, the Trump administration has released a new food pyramid. It's actually upside down from what it used to be. Among the changes is a bigger emphasis on protein, which conveniently is also the latest diet fad. We'll talk about the new inverted food pyramid, why you can find protein in just about everything these days, and what food guidelines you might want to consider. Plus, tax season is upon us again. Normally, this would be a pretty simple conversation, but things are changing this year with the law, given new tax policies created by the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. We'll talk about how to navigate your taxes in 2026. Again, you can go to our website, 21stshow.org, find links to subscribe to our podcast, or look us up on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you listen. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield, Jose Zepeda, and Harrison Melkin. Our digital producer is Colson Kahn. Technical direction and engineering from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick's our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.